I'd like to now introduce our guest speaker for the month of April. Speaking on steps 1 and 2, it's Howard from Gillette.
Can you guys hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Good evening, everybody. My name is Howard. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Howard.
Certainly in my case, it's by the grace of a loving God and by the power that I found as the result of a program in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, and by the support I get from the members of our beautiful fellowship, and by the service that God has blessed me to participate in, I've been separated from alcohol since July 9th, 1983, one day at a time. And for that, I'm very, very grateful. And if you knew me while I was drinking, you'd be grateful I'm sober, too. I want to thank this group for inviting me to share my experience for the month of April. And this is a very special month to me for two reasons. Firstly, it was during the month of April that Bill got together with a couple of his cronies, and they decided to do a deal in Akron, Ohio, and that brought him together with Dr. Bob. And had not been for that, I don't know that I'd be here in front of you today. And also, on the 10th of April, 1939, our big book was published. So that is 64 years ago. And to me, that's very, very special. And I happen to have with me one of those big books that was published in 1939, a first edition, first printing of the book Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't really take it around too much because it's even older than I am. But you can see why they called it a big book. It is a very, very big book. Could you imagine walking in New York City or getting on the subway with a book like this and trying to keep your anonymity? I heard this story from a friend of mine who's a bartender, and he said, Howard, he said, you don't have to read the big book to know the difference between a social drinker, a hard drinker, and an alcoholic. And I says, really? He says, I've been seeing him for many years. I said, tell me about it. He says, if you serve a social drinker a drink, and there happens to be a fly in the drinker will say, ooh, please replace this drink. If you serve a drink with a fly in it to a hard drinker, they'll say, hey, buddy, give me a spoon. And he'll go and he'll take the fly out of the drink and then he'll proceed to drink. But he said, if you serve a drink with a fly in it to a real alcoholic, they get incensed because they don't like anybody touching their booze. And what the alcoholic will do is he'll very gingerly take the fly by both wings and put it over the glass and say, spit it up. I was born in Brooklyn, New York, and when my parents took me from the hospital, if they had foresight, they would have taken me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it really would have prevented many, many years of misery, not so much for them, because my father passed away when I was 14, so he really didn't see any of it. And my mother passed away when I was 26, and she saw some of it. But just the people that I had come in contact with over the years, and I know that everybody who I had any sort of relationship with or association with was adversely affected by my presence in their life. And I think about that, and I feel badly about that. And there's really nothing I can do to change that, except in the present I can change myself not to repeat those things. I came from a family of 9 children, being the youngest, and I learned at a very early age how to manipulate, put one sibling against the other to get what I wanted. I also learned at a very early age that I could get things outside of me to make me feel better about myself. For example, I could manipulate and con a little bit and get a favorite toy that I wanted, and I would feel good for a little while. If I was able to be present when my parents went out for dinner and they let me order from the adult menu, I was happy for a little while. So at a very, very early age, I learned that I could take something from the outside which would make me feel better on the inside. When I was about 8 years old, I discovered alcohol. We were gathered together in a social setting, and liquor was being served. And I noticed that when liquor was present at these occasions, the climate in the room was very, very different. I come from a very loving family, a caring family, but not necessarily a physically demonstrative family. Not necessarily a family where there was a lot of laughter. But when there was alcohol served, there was physical hugging, caressing, there was a lot of laughter. Now, I don't know that I processed this as a kid as I see it today, but all I knew is I wanted what they were drinking. Now, I wasn't allowed to have what they were drinking. However, what I did do is I always volunteered to clean off the table, because if I could clean off the table, I could get the remainder of the beverage left in the drink. And I really enjoyed that tipsy feeling. Now, mind you, it was watered down, but as an eight-year-old, it had an effect on me. From a very early age, I liked the effect produced by alcohol. Now, at 8 years old, how can a person be restless, irritable, and discontented? Well, to some degree I was, unless I got what I wanted. The new toy, the adult menu, whatever the case may be. To watch a TV program, back then there weren't many, but to watch a TV program, things like that. I also remember at about that time that I must have had a drink off of a glass that wasn't quite watered down. You might call it a stiff drink. And I remember getting a nauseating feeling from that. And what I did was I went upstairs to the bathroom and I relieved myself of that drink. And I came back downstairs and I looked for more. Now, I can't imagine an eight-year-old ingesting something that made them feel nauseated that they would want more of. But somewhere in the back of my mind, alcohol was doing for me what I wasn't able to do for myself. I did not know those words, but obviously that was the effect. I also remember at this time, there was this thing going on with polio, and this is before the vaccine. And one of the types of food that parents were advised to feed their children was food that contained a lot of iron. And one food that contained a lot of iron was liver. Now, I don't know about anybody in this room, but I didn't like the way it looked. I didn't like the way it smelled. I didn't like the way it tasted. But I had to eat the liver or else God was going to punish me. Maybe some of you can identify with that. And I did eat the liver. And I remember one time I ate that liver. And I got a nauseating feeling from that liver. And I went up to that very same bathroom on the second floor and I relieved myself of that liver. And it's been almost 50 years I've never had the obsession to eat liver. Now, why is it that I was unable to see the truth time after time after time after time of the first drink? Yet, I could remember that distaste I had for another substance. I have an abnormal reaction to alcohol. I wish somebody would have told me that when I was 8 years old. I would have prevented a lot of misery. I grew up looking forward to having a drink or two whenever I could possibly have it. And then when I was 14 years old, my father passed away. And at this point, I had two thoughts. The first thought is that God really punished me this time, because I grew up in an environment where God was a punishing, judgmental, get even God, how would you do this? God is going to get you, or you don't do that. And finally, God took my father. And the second thing I thought is, why did my father leave me? I used that idea of my father leaving me as an excuse for many, many years to continue the lifestyle that I had. At any rate, what I did, being that I was the man of the house now, and my father left a small business of which I was in charge of, I took over the master bedroom, and I put my mother in my bedroom. And in my father's bedroom, there was a footlocker the whole width of the room with booze. Now, my father was not a drinker, But he used to like to have varieties of alcohol. From that variety of alcohol, I had a variety of religious experiences, I'll tell you that. He had a variety of that alcohol that you couldn't get in the United States, and I partook in that. Also about this time, as I look back, I became a very popular person. Now, to this day, I don't know if I was just a popular person or if I had a lot of booze, but nonetheless, I had a lot of people in my life at that point, peers. And I remember drinking only on weekends for a period of time because I knew I had to do well in school. And I did pretty okay in school for a period of time. But I would look forward to the weekend. And I would look forward to the weekend earlier and earlier and earlier during the week. Like Monday, I was saying, I wish it was Friday. That sort of thing. But alcohol was a solution for me in many respects. As a young boy who was shy, who was insecure, who didn't feel as adequate as other people, I had to partake in certain activities in school, like school dances. And I hated to go to school dances because I was very much intimidated by young girls. And I knew that if I would drink before I went to these dances, I wouldn't be able to stop, and I knew that I would become obnoxious. So what I would do is I would go to these school dances, and I would always bring a bottle of booze with me, small bottle, that I would stash outside somewhere, behind a bush, wherever the case may be. And I would go to these school dances, not because I really wanted to, but in reality you had to, because if you didn't go to the dance on Friday, you had nothing to talk about on Monday, that sort of thing. So I would go to these dances, restless, irritable, and discontented, jumping out of my bag of skin, my nerves were writhing, I couldn't drink because I knew if I drank I couldn't stop, and if I didn't stop I would be obnoxious. But nonetheless, I still went to these dances. And I would walk into it was a gymnasium in Midwood High School. It was a huge gymnasium with parquet floors and two basketball hoops on either end that were turned up toward the ceiling. And they had, you know, like balloons and things, whatever the hell they had. I can't actually remember. And I remember going into this room and my heart was doing one of these things. And I'd look around at all the women in the room and I'd say, I don't like her hair, I don't like her dress, I don't like her shoes, I don't like her smile. Because if I didn't like something about her, I didn't have to ask her. And if I didn't ask her, I wouldn't be rejected. And God forbid she would say yes, I'd be stepping all over her feet. I tell you, it was rough being a kid in my shoes at 15, 16 years old. But suddenly, the thought crossed my mind that I have something outside that's going to change this. I would grab me a couple of hostages who also wanted a drink and didn't have it. And I would take them outside. God forbid I got caught, I could say it was theirs. I was good like that. And I'd have me a couple of drinks real quick. And all of a sudden, my body would be erect. I would have a full head of hair. I had the confidence that when she asked me to dance, I could dance like Fred Astaire. And if she got lucky, I could make love like Don Juan. And I haven't even swallowed it yet. It's still in my mouth. That's what alcohol did for me at a very, very young age. Alcohol was not a problem. Alcohol was a solution for me. And my drinking progressed. And finally, in October of 1973, as a result of my drinking, I got into an automobile accident and I was severely injured, of which I feel to this day. And I remember waking up in a hospital in Brooklyn, Long Island College Hospital on Atlantic Avenue, and I said, I never want to leave this place. I felt like I had died and gone to heaven, and I was okay being in this little room with dark green shades and dark green walls, because when I looked up the ceiling, I thought I was looking at a Monet painting. It was like a garden. It was like indescribably wonderful. It was a feeling that I never ever had before, and it was much better than the feeling that I was getting from alcohol. Because by this point, alcohol wasn't doing for me what it used to do for me. It was still my friend, but it wasn't giving me that real kicker. I was discharged from the hospital, and I went on a quest to get that feeling I had back again. And from 1974 to 1983, my life was a living hell. I was sequestered in an abyss that I could not seem to get out of. It was a horrendous feeling. Being a man at this point, coming from a wonderful family, and looking at myself in the mirror and seeing an individual who vaguely looked familiar. Gaunt, yellow skin, yellow around the whites of my eyes. I mean, it was terrible. And I didn't know what to do. I would wake up in the morning, every single morning, for years, and I would say to myself, this is killing you. You can't do it. You can't do it. And another voice inside of my head would say, Howard, you can't live this way. You can't be with yourself all day. You got to get something. The other voice would say, you can't do it. It's killing you. The other voice would say, you got to do it. There's a mental phenomenon that parallel with my sound reasoning came that insanely trivial excuse for taking the first drink. Insanely trivial in light of the consequences. My sound reasoning failed to hold me in check. And the insane idea won out. I picked up the drink. I didn't know why, but I couldn't stop after that. And I go through the whole day. I finally would go to bed that night. And I'd wake up in the morning, and one part of my head would say, you can't do this, this is killing you. And another part of my head said, you got to do it, you got to get some relief. You can't, you got to, you can't, you got to. It was an incredible existence. And I was a man who, if you looked at, you would say, this man has everything. All the material things that you could possibly want. The family, at some point, the friends. I was successful. Why would somebody like me be doing this? I could never answer that riddle. And my drinking continued. Finally, December 22nd of 1982, I was arrested for a felony on a police officer. And I had to go to court in July, and I went to court, and it was postponed. And I came back from court, and I was sitting in my easy chair in my apartment in Sheepshead Bay. I used to have a nice apartment in Sheepshead Bay. Let me tell you, when I first moved in there, it was as wretched and in as disrepair as I was. It was really horrendous. I mean, it got to be to such a point that when you would take the sheets off my bed, they'd fall apart. They were on so long. If you would drop something on the floor, you would pick it up with a bunch of wool with it. You know, that kind of thing. It was just incredible the way I lived. And I came from a nice family. I came back from court, and Bill talks about his writhing nerves. It's almost like a worm with its head chopped off. You know that dance they do? That's what was going on inside of me. That dance. And I said, I can't take this anymore, man. I said, I got to go out and buy a bottle. There was no you can't. I went out and I bought a bottle of vodka. It was like 100 proof. And it was unusual for me to buy 100 proof anymore because a couple of years before I went to the doctor. And the doctor said to me, Howard, are you drinking much? Nah, a little bit. He says, I don't want to hear anything. You got to cut down 20%. I says, great, I'll drink 80% instead of 100%. No problem. So I went out and I bought the 100%. And I came back to my apartment, and I went into my living room, and I sat down in that broke-down easy chair that was beautiful at one point, and I finished a half a bottle of vodka, and I got drunk. And from the living room to my bedroom, there was a row of carpet tacks on the floor that I failed to pick up. And I stumbled onto that row of carpet tacks, and I was drunk. That's dead weight. And I felt those nails go in the heel of my foot. And I felt those nails come out of the heel of my foot. And I went into my bedroom and I laid down and I says, maybe I'll bleed to death. But God had other ideas because I woke up that morning. And then there was the pain of getting that sheet off of the dried blood. And it started the bleeding all over again. And I said, the hell with this, with a trail. I went into the kitchen. I went into my freezer. And I got me the half a bottle of vodka that I left. And I went into my living room. And I sat in my easy chair. And I drank that other half a bottle of vodka. And I was stone cold sober. I couldn't believe it. A half a bottle of vodka. And I'm saying, this is not even working any longer. See, what alcohol did for me is that it created more problems after a period of time than I used alcohol to escape from. So there was like nowhere to go. Now, I couldn't even get relief. Give me 5 minutes of relief. Stop this inside of me. I can't take it. Little voice inside of my head said, Howard, why don't you pray? I'm looking around. I'm alone. I'm looking around and saying, who's this? I think for a second. I don't know what I said, but it might have been something like this. Dear God, either take me out or show me the way. And the next day I wound up in a rehab from Sheepshead Bay, Brooklyn to Summit, New Jersey. And I spent 9 weeks in this rehab. And to this day, I don't know if I was that sick or if the insurance I had was that good. But nonetheless, I was there for 9 weeks. I learned two things. 70 grand. But praise God, I was separated from alcohol. Two things I learned. The first thing is I have a disease. And the second thing is I need to go to meetings. They really didn't tell me the remedy for my disease, but that's something that I had to find out myself. And I went to a lot of meetings. I was delighted. Meeting makers make it. I said, wow, this is it, baby. I'm cool. I went to a bunch of meetings, and the long and the short of it is, after about 18 months, I wanted to blow my brains out. You take alcohol out of the untreated alcoholic, and you're left with ick. And that's, I was ick. You follow what I mean? I was restless, irritable, and discontented. I was filled with shame, fear, guilt, and remorse from the things I was doing to people I loved who were sober. I was sober and I was doing these things. And I'm saying, how come this AA program isn't working for me? I did a fourth and fifth step. I wrote my life story, which I was told to do. My sponsor at the time took me to page 73, and said, you got to tell somebody all your life story? So I told this guy all my life story. But before I told it to him, I made two appointments and told it to my counselor. I wanted to make sure I got it right before I went to my sponsor. That cost me 90 balloons for the dress rehearsal. And the sponsor said to me, this is wonderful. I've never heard such honesty in my life. But you know what I was doing? I was telling, I was writing down how the world harmed me. So I stayed sick. And I continued to stay sick until God sent a messenger in my life. And I went to a workshop in Sterling called The Way of Life at the Sterling House. And I met a woman there by the name of Sister Mary T. And it was through this woman that I started to get some sort of understanding about the power of God. At any rate, one of the people at this meeting went to Florida. And they went to a big book study there. And they got a flyer about a big book study there. And they brought back the flyer. And she asked me if I would like to go. And I said, sure. And I went to a big book study in May of 1985. And I was in a room with a few hundred other people. And there were two guys in the front of the room. I got to tell you the truth, I wouldn't have had a drink with these guys. I mean, they just weren't my kind of people. I got to tell you that. And they went through the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm sitting there and I'm amazed and I'm resentful. I'm saying to myself, why didn't I learn this in the 20 months I was in AA? Why do I have to go to Florida to get this information? What's the deal here? At any rate, for the first time in 22 months, I learned something about the disease, Alcoholics Anonymous. Why was I at dis-ease all my life? Why was I restless, irritable, and discontented all my life? Why was I always seeking for a sense of relief outside of myself all my life? I used to go out to dinner rarely, but from time to time, through necessity, I had to be with people who were the real alcohol abusers. The people that have one drink and say, that's it. You know what I'm saying? I'll never forget this. I go out to dinner with somebody, and I already know what I'm going to drink, and I say, would you like to have something to drink? And they think about it for a minute because they're not sure. That is beyond my comprehension. You follow? Then they say, yeah, I'd like to have such and such. And it's always a sweet drink that masks the alcohol, and it has to have a lot of ice in it. Fine. I hear it coming because you hear the ice. Anyway, the server puts the drinks down. I'm drinking mine, and they're twirling the sucker. I'm drinking mine, and they're still twirling. I'm saying to myself, what's the deal here? After three drinks, they finish their drink, and I say, would you like another one? Oh, no, I'm feeling this one. Well, what's the purpose of this deal? You know what I'm saying? That's a normal reaction to alcohol. To have one, to have two, maybe, if you want to, and that's it. You get a warm, comfortable feeling, and I'm happy. I was never happy. I was never, ever happy. I spoke to a relative of mine, and I said to her, Shelley, tell me how you feel when you take a drink. And she looked at me like I had three eyes, because social temper drinkers don't talk about booze that way. You know what I mean? And she says, well, I very rarely drink. She says, do you remember about 20 years ago we had that party and I got drunk and I got sick? I never found it necessary or desirable to drink again after that. Now, I was in an automobile accident that nearly took my life, and I couldn't wait to get out of the hospital to get a drink, you know? So I says, tell me what happens if you have more than a couple of drinks. She says, I never have more than a couple of drinks because I don't like that feeling. I says, tell me about it. She says, I start to feel a little out of control. Well, you're getting there. I start to feel a little nauseated, and I start to feel a little tipsy. And I just don't like that feeling. Well, that's not my experience. When I have a drink of alcohol, I get an in-control, exhilarating, give me some more alcohol, get up and do something kind of feeling. Not a slightly tipsy, out of control, beginning of I don't want any more alcohol feeling. That was never in my consciousness from 8 years old till I stopped drinking. You give an alcoholic one or maybe two drinks, they're ready to go to bed. You give me one or two drinks, I'm ready to go to town. A different experience. If 9 out of 10 people drink like my sister, and 1 out of 10 people drink like myself, she's the normal drinker, I'm the abnormal drinker. I never ever knew that. I thought that when a social temper drinker took a drink, their willpower prevented them from taking another drink. It's not their willpower, they just don't want another drink. It was beyond my comprehension. When I took a drink, I needed to have another drink before that drink was gone. And I needed the third drink more than I needed the second, and I needed the eighth more than the seventh. Something within me demanded more, and that those demands were never ever relinquished. They were never ever eased. They were never ever satisfied. They were always more and more and more. And I never knew that. I never knew that when I left the house and I said I'll be back in a half hour, and I really meant it, and I would go down the street and I would see some people in the saloon, and I would say to myself, I got to be back in a half hour, but it's 10 minutes back. I got to pick up something for 5 minutes, so I got 15 minutes to kill. You know what I'm saying? And I would go into the saloon, and I would sit down and I'd have a drink. And the next thing will be 3 or 4 hours later. And I didn't mean it when I went in there. I really didn't mean it. But something happened inside of my body that demanded more alcohol once I put alcohol in my system. I wish I would have known that back then. See, my body, as an alcoholic, reacts to alcohol differently than 90% of the people on the face of this earth. And my mind thinks about alcohol differently than 90% of the people on the face of this earth. Trust me, social temper drinkers don't have drunk dreams. They just don't. It's beyond their comprehension. You know? So my mind is different and my body is different. And that's what separates me as a distinct entity from 90% of the people on the face of this earth. I also have another component. I have what our book calls a spiritual malady. A malady, an unwholesome condition. Unwholesome, not whole. My spiritual condition is not whole. There's something missing in my spiritual condition. I'm effectively blocked off from God. If I'm blocked off from God, I'm running on self. Self wants ease and comfort, not from within, but from without. Restless, irritable, and discontented, need something to fix it. Filled with shame, fear, guilt, and remorse, need something to fix it. Trying to direct the show, you don't listen, need something to fix it. Take from the outside, put in the inside. Many people have spiritual maladies. I'm 1 in 9 kids. 8 of them have spiritual maladies. They just don't know it. They're resentful. They're full of fear. They harm people through their actions. They're restless, irritable, and discontented. They're just not aware of it. Thank God I am aware of it and I can do something about it. When I got the information about my illness, and for the first time I realized that is my thinking, and that is my body, that makes me an alcoholic. Then I realized that I could cast the body aside for a moment and deal with my thinking. Because if I never drank, my body would never be affected. I'm allergic to lobster. I just don't eat it. There's no manifestation from not eating lobster. But why is it that from time to time, my mind would tell me, Howard, you haven't had a drink in a while. This time it's going to be different. See, I begin to realize that the body does what the mind tells it to do. And if my mind gives my body permission to pick up a drink of alcohol, saying that there's no problem in picking up that drink of alcohol, that's what my body is going to do. And once it does that, then I trigger the physical component of my illness, and then I'm off again and again and again and again. So the question for me is, what do I do about my thinking? If I can't bring into my thoughts with sufficient power the memory of the suffering, of the humiliation, of the degradation, of the harm that I created in other people's lives, let alone my own, if I can't bring into my consciousness the consequences, then of my own power, I am without defense against that first drink. I never ever knew that. Willpower only works when my mind sees what it's about to do is incorrect or harmful or hurtful. For example, if I'm walking at night and there's no stars out and no moon and it's pitch black, my mind is going to say, Howard, you got to be careful because you may trip and hurt yourself. When I come to a corner and there's traffic both ways, my mind says to me, Howard, you got to stop and look because you can get hurt, unless I'm the jaywalker, but that's another deal. So you see, willpower works in many, many instances in my life. I was unable to see the truth about the first drink because I suffer from something called insanity. Doesn't mean I'm crazy. Insanity means there's something missing out of the whole. Means there's something missing out of the whole. Sanity is defined as soundness and wholeness of mind. Therefore, insanity is a mind that's less than whole. So there's something missing in my thinking that is unable to see the truth about the first drink. I can see the truth about the dark outside. I can see the truth about the street corner. I could see the truth about the liver. I could never see the truth about the first drink. And based on the lie, I would pick up that drink. I trigger the physical component, and boom, I'm off. So my real problem centers in my mind. Lack of power. You know, I don't know if you've ever experienced a solar eclipse. The sun is the most powerful source of light known to man. Yet, something comes in front of it and blocks it off. I had a spiritual eclipse. God is the most powerful force on the face of this earth, but self could block it. So in essence, self could be more powerful than God, if that's what I feed into. I never knew that. I thought I could handle everything. My experience shows me that I couldn't, but my mind said it could. I was obsessed. An obsession is an idea that's so powerful that it overcomes the truth and allows me to believe the lie that this time it's going to be different. This time there's going to be no consequences. I did this for 19 years. I remember when I was a kid, I was coming out of the bathroom, out of the bathtub. I was 5 years old. You know the satiny skin on a five-year-old, and you know the tush is real small. I accidentally backed up on a radiator and raised a welt the size of a quarter on my little rear end. I got to tell you, it hurt. It really, really hurt. It's over 50 years since then. I've never got up to a radiator and drop my drawers and say, maybe this time it won't burn me. Alcohol did that to me every single day. I'm able to see the truth about one thing, but not about the other. I'm not crazy. I'm insane. My mind is less than whole. I have an unwholesome spiritual condition, my spiritual malady. I never knew that. If I am powerless over alcohol, there's an inference that I need a power. Usually the solution is the opposite of the problem. I need a power greater than ourselves collectively to restore me to seeing the truth, a state of sanity, before I pick up the first drink. I need a power greater than myself. I'll tell you my problem. I always thought that that power was God. And I didn't want anything to do with God, because my experience growing up as a kid is that God is a punishing, judgmental, get-even God. Took my father when I was 14, allowed me to drink myself to death, nearly killed myself in an automobile accident. God showed me what he had in store for me. I wanted no part of that. But I was faced with an alternative: to be doomed an alcoholic death. I knew what that was about. I really didn't want to go back there or to accept spiritual health. I didn't know what that was about, but I figured if it was that bad, I could always go back and be doomed. It was still difficult, though. Very, very difficult for me. And I had some suggestions to look back and see how powerless I was and where my thinking got me. And then to come to a point where I had to decide whether God was going to be it or God was not going to be it. Now, how am I going to do that? Well, I was given some suggestions. The first thing was to lay aside whatever preconceived notions I had about God, that he was that punishing, judgmental, get-even God that I grew up with. Lay those aside for a moment. Believe in the existence of a God. And I did. I was an agnostic. I believed that God existed. But because you couldn't prove God to me, I wasn't going to take a chance. So I ran on my own power, just like the atheist, even though I did believe in God. And the third thing was to come up with a conception or an idea of God, whatever I thought it was. Didn't have to be anything gigantic. Could be actually very limited. And then become willing to believe in that newfound conception. And let me tell you something. When my back was up against the wall, I bought into this. And I began to think, for many, many years, there was always a voice inside of me that told me what to do and what not to do. Howard, this is not a good idea. Howard, this is a good idea. Howard, you're lying. You shouldn't be doing that. Howard, you're living in this way. You shouldn't be doing that. In my particular case, there was always a larger voice that said, the hell with that little voice. You're going to do what you want to do when you want to do it. I eclipsed God. And I did what I wanted to do. And I wound up in all kinds of trouble. I was 37 years old when I got sober. Praise God. 37. I got into all kinds of trouble. And when I would settle down, that little voice inside of me would say, why don't you listen to me next time? I'm going to set you straight. But whenever a situation came up again where I heard that little voice, the big voice always won out because I wanted what I wanted when I wanted it. And I spent my whole life doing that. I learned that as a child, that you got to get what you want to make you feel better. With this new conception that I have of God, I was able to accept spiritual help in my life. And all those people that I resented for talking about God became people that I wanted to become closer to. The first sober resentment that I had, I was in the rehab. And I remember getting up in the morning on my way to breakfast and seeing these people in the hallway, a group, four, five, six people, with the Bible open and praying. And I said, that's not for me. Today, I like to speak to those people. Of course, maybe I can learn from those people how to get closer to this God. I always wondered where God was. Is he up there? Is he down there? Is he here? Is he there? Is he in the church? Where is God? And it was confusing to me because in the religious service, when they would speak to God, they'd look up at the ceiling. But yet when we pray, they'd be looking down at the floor. Saying to myself, where is this God? Is he up there or down there? And do you know, I've never found a question yet that I couldn't find an answer for in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And they tell me where God is, right inside of me. The last place that I would look is inside of me. Impossible that it's there. So I began to realize that my solution is right within. It's not out there. It's not over there. It's not in anybody else. For many years, it had to be in another person. It's right inside of me. I knew that my answers were within, and I have a program of recovery that is going to enable me to remove those things that were blocking God, the eclipse, if you will, and I can begin to tap into God's power. I look at somebody today that's spiritually sick, like somebody who's either hard of hearing or deaf. They can't hear God's power, his way of life, his knowledge, his love. Some people go to God only when there's a problem. Those are the people that are hard of hearing. Some people never go to God because they don't believe God exists. These people are deaf. This little analogy helped me when I got through the inventory process, because I realized that the people who harmed me were spiritually sick. And it was much, much easier for me to forgive people like that than it would be any other way. I'm grateful that I have had in my life in Alcoholics Anonymous wonderful friends, wonderful teachers, and the ability to listen and learn and not shut off information because I don't agree with it. That was real growth for me, accepting things today that at some point were entirely out of my reach. I'm very, very delighted that I'm having this experience, because if you knew me while I was drinking, I was the kind of guy where the room lit up when I left. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I didn't realize when I partook in this process, and mind you, I was in AA 22 months before I partook in this process. So actually, I was in the fellowship, and God's grace kept me sober for 22 months. I know people in this room know there's a difference between the fellowship and the program, so that's why I don't have to get into it. But I was into that fellowship. You know what my favorite slogan was? Exit. It was on the wall.
Yeah.
Right? I'm delighted to be here. I'm grateful that I've had an opportunity to share a little bit about myself. And I look forward to meeting you all again next week, when I will talk to you about my decision to accept spiritual help, and also the simple little process that I partook in, which enabled me to remove the blocks that separated me from the God of my understanding. I would like to close, if I may, with a couple of paragraphs and a vision for you. A book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we only know a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask Him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with Him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. We'll close with what prayer?
Seven-step
prayer.
Share for me.